Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, folks, episode number 84. It's Saturday, October 17th. I am recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Welcome to the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, folks, COVID-19 is still the number one story in America. Though, I will be spending most of our time on the show today on non-COVID-19 news and research. I'm trying to reopen my show. Still, it's impossible to ignore. We've reached an inflection point this week with the pandemic here in the U.S. This week, we hit the day when no U.S. state, not a single state, had less new COVID-19 cases than the week before. Nationally, COVID-19 infections have gone up 17% in the last week. This is a trajectory that could have us at a record high cases by Election Day. And a little closer to home in Ohio, from the Columbus Dispatch, as daily COVID-19 cases top 2,000 for third day, experts say Ohio at crucial crossroads. Governor Mike DeWine announced on Thursday that a record 29 counties are now at red level 3 COVID-19 advisory. The updated advisories mean more than 65% of Ohioans now live in a red level county. In recent weeks, DeWine and other medical leaders have also warned that the virus is spreading more in rural Ohio counties. Friday marked the third day in a row Ohio reported more than 2,000 coronavirus cases. Before Wednesday, more than 2,000 cases had never even been reported in a single day in Ohio. Yikes. But of course, this is yesterday's news. Literally, today, we had the fourth day in a row over 2,000 and a new record. Ohio's numbers of new cases have gone up by over a third the last week, and the last 4 days have been the highest 4 days since the beginning of the pandemic. Lucas County moved up to level red this week. Unfortunately, Lucas County is in good company, as all of Ohio's metropolitan counties are now at level red. Plus, as in recent weeks, Ohio's rural counties are even more likely to have a high rate of new cases than metro counties. Okay, well, in the last couple of weeks, I've reported the fact that the Toledo-Lucas County Health Department had stopped for 3 weeks reporting the number of tests that we've done, and this is significant because that would mean no longer able to calculate the positivity rate. In other words, the proportion of tests that are performed that turn out to be positive. And we were running 8-10% in those weeks before they stopped doing it. Well, they started earlier this week. I did talk to the epidemiologist at the health department, and they said that they were reworking something with the numbers and they were going to start soon, and sure enough, they did. Now, there was no explanation in the report that they issued as far as what they might have changed in the way they were counting tests, but in the 3 weeks from the time previously that reported the number of tests, that big gap of 3 weeks where they hadn't reported it to the first time they reported it, there were 1,743 tests in 3 weeks. That's less than 100 tests a day. That's a very low level than what we've been doing in recent weeks and months prior to that. And they had 613 positives over that same time. That is a positivity rate of 35%. If that's right, that is scary. I think that can't be right. But if we have two problems. Either we have a super high positivity rate, or the data that we have is bad. And in talking with the epidemiologist, she sent me a link saying, oh, well, here's another place where you can get the positivity rate for Ohio. And sure enough, I got that and looked at it. And it wasn't the rate for the entire community. It was the rate in nursing homes, long-term care facilities, which are required by the federal government to do testing and to report on it. And those rates are much lower. That is 3.3% 2 weeks ago, 3.6% this week. But that's below the 5% that they say, is kind of a level to try to keep it down below and might indicate that you're doing enough testing. So that's good. And that's a targeted population, one that should be protected and monitored, surveyed very closely. Okay. Well, I don't know if there's some goofy thing in that 3 weeks testing the way they changed them, perhaps the way they're reporting the numbers. But if you look at just the last 3 days of the new tests that reported, we had 733 tests over 3 days. So that's over 200 tests a day, getting a little bit better. Still not as high as we've seen in the past, though. And 96 positives. And this turns out to be a 13% positivity rate. That is not very good. Okay, so things seem to be getting worse here in the country, in the state, and in Lucas County. In Lucas County nursing homes, the number of active cases stayed relatively steady, moved from 23 to 27 over the last 2 weeks. Like I said before, the positivity rate for testing in the long-term care facilities and nursing homes was 3.6%. Not terrible. University of Toledo, the cases stayed about stable. They, in the last 3 weeks, were 28 cases, 27 cases, and 25 cases, the most recent. So going down slightly, but staying relatively stable. Now, they are actually doing some random surveillance testing where they send an email out to 500 students and ask them to come in and get tested. They're not reporting how many of those people are responding to that, but they are reporting the positivity. And in the last week, they had a 1.5% positivity of students that were just picked at random and were tested. That may not be exactly random, because it might depend on, there might be a difference between the people that actually respond to that and the people that don't. But either way, this is varied from 1-3% the prior week. But at a 1.5 positivity rate with over 20,000 people in the UT campus community, that would still mean they have 300 plus positive folks walking around. So, and this is a rate that's higher than the community at large. What about Lucas County schools? Well, we've had the most cases of staff and students reported of any of the previous 4 weeks that since they started school and reporting. They had 12 staff and 13 students that reported positive cases. But again, they're not doing any kind of standard, regular testing. This is just basically on an as-needed basis. When somebody thinks they've been exposed to a positive, or whether that's in the school or in the community, it's not really any different than the rest of the community. And that rate of positivity is actually higher in Lucas County schools among staff and students than it is in the broader community. Take that for what it's worth. Obviously, younger people are being affected more than the rest of the community as a whole when you look at the Lucas County schools and the University of Toledo as an example for young adults. And so it goes.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you. at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, let's take a look at how this surge in cases nationwide is playing out in one community. This from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Surge in COVID-19 cases means fewer Minnesota schools meet in-person rules. Rising numbers of COVID-19 cases and outbreaks in Minnesota schools are narrowing the list of counties where the virus is spreading at low enough rates to allow for full in-person instruction. Statewide, more than 500 schools had at least one positive case in the last 2 weeks, and 24 public and private schools reported outbreaks with at least 5 positive cases, according to the Minnesota Department of Health data released Thursday. But health officials facing increasing challenges from parents, students, and community members trying to conceal the spread of the virus to keep schools open and sports programs running, says those numbers are almost certainly an undercount. Susan Clammer, an epidemiologist with the department, said in some communities, resistance to testing or quarantining after COVID-19 exposure has become more pronounced, and in some cases, hostile, in the period since the Minnesota State High School League restarted school sports programs. Clammer said police have been called in cases where health workers were threatened for recommending that students quarantine, and students were threatened and harassed by their peers after seeking COVID-19 testing. Health officials have been notified of schools where groups of students have made pacts not to get tested and to keep quiet if they think they are sick or have been exposed to the virus. It is incredible how the tenor has changed in the last couple of weeks, Clammer said. Well, folks, if you want to keep our schools open, we have to work together to keep the numbers down, whether that's an outbreak in a school or, more importantly, in your community at large, which the schools reside within. Okay, well, next up from Politico, want to do a story to do a little survey on what's happening on the healthcare front as the surge accelerates. Overwhelmed, hospitals engulfed by rebounding virus. The pandemic is spawning new infections at a rate not seen since the end of July. The coronavirus is engulfing big city hospitals in states including Utah, Wisconsin, and Indiana that are running low on nurses and beds and are being forced to set up overflow facilities. Our hospitals are getting overwhelmed, Republican Utah Governor Gary Herbert said this week. The dramatic increase in infections has put the integrity of our healthcare system at risk. The University of Utah Health System, one of the largest hospitals in the state, reported its ICU is 95% filled, and health systems in other parts of the country have been forced to relocate patients because of bed and staffing shortages. Herbert said the National Guard is on standby to build a field hospital in a convention center outside Salt Lake City, and on Tuesday he ordered masks be worn at all outdoor events. In Indiana, the state is facing critical ICU bed shortages along with personnel shortages, according to Chief Medical Officer Lindsay Weaver, only 3 weeks after Republican Governor Eric Holcomb removed most COVID-related restrictions. Officials have put out a call for volunteers to help fill staffing shortages in hard-hit facilities near the Michigan and Kentucky borders. This is especially concerning because we have not yet begun to see the typical increase in ICU bed usage from influenza, Weaver said. Colder weather pushing more people together indoors appears to be driving the latest surge more than school reopenings, according to public health experts. Other areas could soon face similar dilemmas, with U.S. hospitalizations at their highest point since the end of August, according to the COVID Tracking Project. Wisconsin, where President Donald Trump holds a rally today, opened a field hospital on its state fairgrounds in West Allis on Wednesday after officials said the healthcare system is in crisis. Many of our ICUs are strained, said Julie Willems Van Dyke, a deputy secretary of the state's health department. Every region of our state is one or more hospitals reporting current and imminent staff shortages. Democratic Governor Tony Evers' administration asked the Army Corps of Engineers to review plans for two more field hospitals. The situation appears similarly dire in parts of Texas, Missouri, and Oklahoma. Meanwhile, two out of three major hospitals in Albuquerque, New Mexico, are at or exceeding capacity. Democratic Governor Michelle Grisham on Thursday announced that restaurants and bars must close at 10 p.m. and gatherings of more than five would be prohibited. This is the most serious emergency New Mexico has ever faced, she said. In Missouri, hospitals are reaching capacity in every region of the state. ICU beds are very limited in several regions, said Dave Dillon, a spokesperson for the Missouri Hospital Association. Hospitals are working collaboratively to manage patient flow, but Missourians still have heart attacks, strokes, and automobile accidents, for example, that demand ICU care. This is a finite resource, and if Missouri cannot bring down the infection rate, we will meet or exceed our capacity to care for the most critical COVID-19 patients. In Fargo, North Dakota's most populous city, there were 10 ICU beds available on Wednesday, and in Bismarck, the state capital, there was only one, according to the health department. Republican Governor Doug Burgum on Wednesday recommended that bars, restaurants, and other large venues in the state's most populated counties serve only a quarter of their capacity and no more than 50 people, but declined to require them to do so. The recent spike in infections, the coming winter, and the prospect of holiday travel and gatherings have many physicians worried that the hospital numbers are only going to get worse. This is not going to go away for the next several months, said Mark Dowell, an infectious disease doctor at the Wyoming Medical Center in Casper, where on Wednesday morning every room was occupied and 17 patients were holding on in the emergency room. Our hospital is already stretched, and we are not even seeing the amount of COVID we are going to see, Dowell said. Okay, folks, well, there's a lot of bad news there. The good news is we're done with the COVID-19 reporting for this week on this show. Even though things are getting really bad, I have some other things I'd like to cover and focus on something other than COVID-19 for a change. Okay, well, in public health, we know that a focus on having a lot of pharmaceuticals and therapies on the shelf does not necessarily translate to health in the community. For one thing, those tools may not actually be implemented in the community. And this is a story regarding that. This from Stat News. Hepatitis is still a silent killer in Africa and elsewhere. The Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine was awarded last week to three researchers who discovered the virus that causes hepatitis C. According to the announcement, for the first time in history, the disease can now be cured, raising hopes of eradicating hepatitis C virus from the world population. New blood tests and drugs for this deadly disease have already saved millions of lives. But for millions more around the world, the celebration is bittersweet, and the revolution in diagnosis and treatment remains a distant dream. In Africa, dying from viral hepatitis is becoming a bigger threat than dying from HIV/AIDS or malaria. Although there are five types of viral hepatitis, A, B, C, D, and E, chronic B and C cause nearly all hepatitis-related sickness and untimely deaths. In my home country, Nigeria, nearly 8% of the population is believed to be infected with hepatitis B and over 1.1% with hepatitis C. This year, in Africa alone, these diseases will kill 200,000 people. The majority of those who have viral hepatitis don't know it. And in most countries, including my own, the vast majority of those who are sick are not getting diagnosed and treated until it's too late to save them. One of these was my mother. No one knew she had hepatitis, even though we took her to the hospital over and over again each time her eyes, quote, turned yellow. The doctors would dismiss it as a mild fever, prescribe some painkillers, and send her home. 15 years after these symptoms started, she was diagnosed with end-stage liver cancer caused by the infection. It was too late to save her. Some people get the virus from their mothers at birth. Some get it through sexual contact, or because healthcare providers do not properly screen blood transfusions or sterilize equipment. Shared needles, sharp objects at home, and traditional practices such as circumcision, tattooing, and scarification also spread the disease. Hepatitis B and C may cause few obvious symptoms for many years. One reason it often goes undetected. Another is that many of those infected are children and the poor, marginalized people with little access to healthcare, and those who do not know they have the virus infect others. It doesn't have to be this way. Like hepatitis C, hepatitis B can be detected, even in people who exhibit no symptoms. Hepatitis B infection is preventable with vaccinations and treatable if caught early. In awarding the 2020 prize to researchers Harvey Alter, Michael Houghton, and Charles Rice, the Nobel Committee noted that while the earlier discoveries of the hepatitis A and B viruses had been a critical step forward, before their work on hepatitis C, most bloodborne hepatitis cases remained unexplained. The discovery of hepatitis C virus revealed the cause of the remaining cases of chronic hepatitis and made possible blood tests and new medicines that have saved millions of lives, except in places like Nigeria, where those life-saving tests and treatments are either unaffordable or inaccessible. It costs only 20 cents to vaccinate a baby against hepatitis B, but this vaccine is not available in most countries. I'm going to repeat that. It costs only 20 cents to vaccinate a baby against hepatitis B, but this vaccine is not available in most countries. Yikes. The price for the generic drug that can cure hepatitis is about $900. The medicine for treating chronic hepatitis B costs about $15 per month. Yet in Nigeria, at least half the population lives on less than $2 per day. More than 90% of Nigerians lack health insurance, and there is no government-funded hepatitis treatment program. Most people can't even pay for the $100 blood test needed to start treatment, let alone for the drugs themselves. Those who try to fund their own treatment out of pocket find themselves driven into poverty. Geography is another barrier. Most Nigerians live in rural communities, often far from major cities and hospitals, where doctors have the training and equipment they need to diagnose, treat, and manage hepatitis. And these infections hit low-income, rural, and marginalized populations the hardest. The COVID-19 pandemic has exacerbated these problems by disrupting pharmaceutical supply chains. Drug prices have shot up, and patients who were on hepatitis C drugs can no longer get them. No one who could step in to stop the epidemic is doing it. Governments and international funders like the Global Fund, PEPFAR, and the Gates Foundation are focused on other diseases such as HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. The billions of dollars they have spent have changed the landscape for these diseases and offered hope. Viral hepatitis, though, remains an orphan. According to the joint United Nations HIV/AIDS program report, the estimated funds available for responding to HIV/AIDS in low- and middle-income countries in 2014 stood at $19.2 billion, compared to less than $100 million invested in fighting hepatitis across the globe. This has real consequences on the ground. People with HIV are now getting the antiviral drug tenofovir for free, provided by international funders like PEPFAR. But tenofovir is also used to treat chronic hepatitis B, and people with hepatitis can get it only if they're able to pay full price for it. Unlocking the mystery of hepatitis C was a towering achievement, but the next essential step is to ensure that this discovery reaches its potential to alleviate the suffering and save the lives of millions of people in countries like mine. The global response to HIV and now COVID-19 has shown us what can be achieved when government, civil society, international organizations, and the private sector work together with a common goal. It's time to make eradicating hepatitis such a goal. Okay, well, with that story about Africa and different health problems, I'd like to switch gears a little bit and come back to the African diaspora, that is African Americans in this country, and the health problems and disparities that they face. And I've covered some of this before, but some new good information. This from Stat News: how the CDC and others are failing black women during childbirth. The alarming number of deaths of black women during childbirth and soon afterward once gained little national attention. That changed partly because of the high-profile deaths of Dr. Shailen Irving and Kyra Johnson, and the delayed response to Serena Williams' request for treatment of a post-delivery complication. In each of these cases, the women or her family asked for help with one or more known warning signs of complications, like severe pain and difficulty breathing, and were not heard. Sadly, that happens all too often. From the rich and famous to the less well-to-do, black mothers are often not listened to when they report signs of possible complications of pregnancy and birth. Not only are their concerns dismissed, but traumatic birthing experiences are so common that 1/4 of black women report disrespect and abuse from medical professionals in the hospital. Deaths and severe complications related to pregnancy and childbirth are the tip of the iceberg of medical harm experienced by black birthing people. From rushed prenatal visits to unnecessary and unwanted cesarean births, which can cause postpartum infections and wound problems. Childbirth is far more hazardous for black women than white women. In New York State, the Department of Health found that 3 times more black women died from pregnancy-related complications than white women, and this disparity persisted even when college-educated black women were compared with non-black women who did not finish high school. More than 60% of these deaths are preventable if appropriate care is given in a timely fashion. In California, where improvements in care were implemented as soon as the crisis in maternal deaths was recognized in 2005, the overall maternal mortality rate dropped from 17 per 100,000 births to 7 by 2013. Despite this improvement, the racial disparity of 3 times as many black women dying around the time of childbirth persisted in California. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the majority of maternal deaths are preventable. In an effort to reduce the number of maternal deaths in the United States, the CDC launched the Hear Her campaign. In conjunction with the CDC, the Council on Patient Safety and Women's Healthcare launched the Urgent Maternal Warning Signs Tool. These join other warning sign tools and video campaigns from the Association of Women's Health, Obstetric and Neonatal Nurses, the March of Dimes, and the Preeclampsia Foundation, to name a few. Even MTV has the Save Our Moms campaign. These efforts are welcome because of the lack of effective patient education for pregnant women, but they fail women in a crucial way. They blame mothers for their poor outcomes and fail to address providers' tendencies to dismiss moms' complaints. The CDC's Hear Her campaign and the Council's Warning Sign Signal tool tell mothers and their supporters that they are responsible for changing their behavior, improving their own outcomes, and preventing their own complications related to childbirth. These online and social media tools and videos do not address how racism affects providers' communication and decision-making when black mothers let them know that they are experiencing warning signs. Will the nurse and doctors who are receiving announcements of these programs actually reflect on their racial biases and recognize that mothers should not be blamed for their poor outcomes when they are not heard or educated by their providers? I do not expect that the CDC will declare racism a public health crisis, as many local and state departments of health have done, even though 1,200 employees of the CDC wrote a letter to Director Robert Redfield protesting a, quote, toxic culture of exclusion and racial discrimination. The first of their 7 demands was to declare racism a public health crisis in the United States. The Black Coalition for Safe Motherhood, an organization I co-founded, promotes healthcare advocacy and holistic support for black moms through interactive community programs. The focus of our programming is overcoming the obstacles to obtaining safe, respectful, person-centered care that honors the values, preferences, and needs of black moms and families is the focus of our programming. The coalition curriculum encourages black women and their supporters to ask questions, claim your space, trust your body, and tell your story. It also takes advocacy a big step further. The program participants practice asserting themselves when they are not heard or are dismissed or disrespected in medical settings. The Hear Her campaign puts providers last on the list of those encouraged to listen to mothers' concerns and does little to address the problem of not hearing black mothers. The Urgent Maternal Warning Signs tool lists symptoms to be recognized during and after childbirth as requiring care that black women have recognized, asked for help with, and then have been denied life-saving treatment and care. Black people have long suffered unequal treatment and poor communication with providers, despite alarms from the public health sector, including but not limited to the landmark report unequal treatment, confronting racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare. The persistence of racial stereotypes in medicine and their impact on treatment was underscored by a study showing that 50% of physicians in training hold false beliefs about black people's bodies. Until racism in medicine and medical education is eliminated, the, quote, care of black people will continue to be unequal, disrespectful, and often harmful. Martin Luther King wrote, "Whites, it must frankly be said, are not putting in a similar mass effort to re-educate themselves out of their racial ignorance. It is an aspect of their sense of superiority that the white people of America believe they have so little to learn. It's time for medical professionals and professional organizations to re-educate themselves, to recognize and eliminate racism, patriarchy, and elitism in medicine, so all women can experience safe and effective and respectful maternity care, and we can close the shameful disparity in maternal deaths." Okay, and next up, a story about how we can address these black maternal mortality rates. This from The Hill. Black maternal mortality rates and the implicit biases. How can we address them? Maybe you've heard the story of Kyra Johnson. In April 16, Kyra died from severe internal hemorrhaging hours after giving birth by routine cesarean to her second son. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, half of all maternal mortalities in the U.S. are preventable. In Kyra's case, her doctors cut her bladder during her cesarean and then allegedly failed to act. For over 10 hours, Kyra's family begged doctors to investigate visible signs of internal bleeding, which the doctors ignored until it was too late. If you don't know Kyra's story, you probably know someone like Kyra who tragically lost their life while trying to bring a child into this world, or you know someone that came close to losing their life during childbirth. Although maternal mortality in the U.S. affects women from all places and all backgrounds at high rates, it disproportionately impacts women of color. Research also suggests women of color experience discrimination from their maternal care providers, and their birthing outcomes, particularly among black women, correlate to their experience of racism. Most alarming is that black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related deaths than white women. To combat rising maternal mortality rates and the implicit biases that affect them, we need to move forward on legislative action. Several bills in Congress address the issue. Still, the Black Maternal Health Caucus's Momdibus and the Mothers and Offspring Mortality and Morbidity Awareness Act, or MAMAs, would specifically address maternal health disparities through improving data collection and reporting on maternal mortality, improving maternal care, expanding Medicaid and CHIP coverage, and advancing respectful, equitable care. Currently, the U.S. has no official maternal mortality rate, because there is no standardized process for how states report and analyze deaths, nor is the data aggregated at the federal level. As a result, the CDC is unable to discern causes or establish preventive measures around maternal mortality. We need a reporting process that is uniform. We must put systems in place to regularly collect data at the federal level and share it with healthcare providers and researchers. By streamlining the data collection process, we can also improve maternal care, including providers' ability to recognize maternal complications and signs of maternal distress that often result in infant maternal mortality. Another issue related to maternal care and mortality is the lack of insurance coverage in the months following delivery. In 2017, 43% of births were covered by Medicaid, mostly for women of color. Still, Medicaid coverage ends approximately 60 days postpartum, while half of the maternal deaths happen between 42 days and 1 year postpartum. To help prevent these deaths, the Mamas Act seeks to extend Medicaid coverage for pregnant women to 1 year after they give birth. We need to ensure that even after their babies are born, mothers are still cared for. Finally, we have to directly address the disproportionate impact of maternal mortality on women of color by training providers in offering care that is culturally competent and free of implicit bias. Health systems must be aware and respectful of cultural norms when providing care, and be mindful of buying into stereotypes based on race, ethnicity, and even underlying medical conditions like diabetes, which often lead to perceived discrimination and perpetuate systems of injustice. Finally, health systems must be accountable to mothers and families and have processes for listening to concerns about respectful care and addressing those concerns head-on. The U.S. has the highest maternal mortality rates in the developed world. Behind every death is a tragic story like Kyra's that is completely preventable. In our country, children are growing up motherless because our healthcare system has failed their families. Mothers should not die when we have all the medical resources to save them. Congress must take action and pass the Momnibus and the Mama's Acts so that families have what they need to grow with dignity. Okay, well, sticking to the same vein, I want to move on to another related issue. This from Zora. What no one tells black women about breastfeeding. Breastfeeding is good for mom and baby, but stigma and medical discrimination keep many black women from trying. After Kimberly Seals Allers gave birth to her son, she went to the local Olathe League meeting to get support from other breastfeeding moms. But there was nobody who looked like me, and certainly there was nobody who was going back to work like I was, she told Zora. It was really white and stay-at-home mother-centered. Seals Allers says her breastfeeding journey with her son ended up being much shorter than with her older daughter. She didn't get advice on how to start weaning her son or when to start pumping to build up a stash of breast milk. I did not have the support, she says. I did not know people who I could talk to. Seals Allers, a journalist, maternal and infant health advocate, and author of The Big Letdown, How Medicine, Big Business, and Feminism Undermine Breastfeeding, says this is one of the many experiences that prompted her to co-found Black Breastfeeding Week, which is held in August. The week aims to educate families about breastfeeding and amplify stories and images of black breastfeeding in order to make a cultural shift. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that infants drink breast milk exclusively for the first 6 months of their life, citing benefits for infants including reduced risk of respiratory issues, gastrointestinal infections, sudden infant death syndrome or SIDS, allergies, and more. Recent data suggests that the breastfeeding initiation rate for black moms is 58% compared to 81% for Hispanic Latinx populations and 82% for white moms. And while breastfeeding won't be possible for every family, experts believe that these disparities can be largely attributed to a systemic lack of education and support rather than personal choice. The lack of institutional support breastfeeding black mothers face from healthcare providers, from the healthcare providers' field is shameful, but not surprising. We're all aware of the racial disparities black moms and babies face. Black moms are 3 times more likely than white ones to die from pregnancy or childbirth. Black babies are twice as likely to die than white ones. More healthcare disparities can be found in the healthcare services black families receive. PBS reports that hospital maternity wards serving majority black populations were less likely to help black women initiate breastfeeding after giving birth or offer lactation support following delivery. This issue is only compounded by deeply painful cultural histories. Think about the historical legacy and the trauma with breastfeeding in our community, Seals Allers says. During slavery, black women were stopped from breastfeeding our own children and forced to breastfeed the children of our white oppressors. Imagine what it would be like to be denied that bond with your own child. Seals Allers says that complex cultural narratives about breastfeeding, coupled with the hypersexualization of black women's bodies, contribute to these disparities. Another major culprit? We have found that disproportionately black women and their families are not receiving information about breastfeeding, and nobody's encouraging them to breastfeed. The hope is that raising awareness about breastfeeding and normalizing it for black folks will lead to an uptick in moms who are interested in learning more. If that's the case, where do you start? Breastfeeding classes are a great resource for parents looking to learn more about breastfeeding, says Camila Phillips, MD, a board-certified OB-GYN, and founder of Kala Women's Health in New York City. These classes help you understand the benefits of breastfeeding for mom and baby and can help empower your decision and commitment to breastfeed. Hospitals typically have certified lactation consultants available to meet with moms and newborns, which is a service you should absolutely opt for if you're interested in breastfeeding. They can observe the mommy-baby dyad during nursing, Phillips says. They can make suggestions and necessary adjustments to help get breastfeeding off to a good start. They can also make telehealth visits and observe the feeding when you are at home. It can also be helpful for moms to know that what potential roadblocks to look out for. A common thing I hear from black breastfeeding moms is that no one told them how to determine if their baby is getting enough milk, and no one told them how to properly latch, says Crystal Duhaney, RN, founder of lactation support company Milky Mama. These two items are vital to having a successful breastfeeding journey. Duhaney says that knowing what's normal, sore nipples, versus what might signal a problem, cracked nipples, can also empower moms to know that they need expert support. Experts say that a supportive community can make a major difference. According to a small 2019 study published in the Journal of Human Lactation, online support groups can positively influence breastfeeding norms and confidence in breastfeeding and help moms breastfeed for longer. You can look on Facebook for local groups or check out national organizations like the Black Mothers Breastfeeding Association. This type of support is especially crucial for working moms who have to plan around commuting, pumping at work, and storing their breast milk on the go. While COVID-19 has disrupted in-person services, virtual support groups are easier than ever to access, and many lactation specialists have pivoted to online work. Another helpful tip? Get family and friends on your side. You want to have as many breastfeeding cheerleaders in your corner as possible, Duhaney says. Find a knowledgeable lactation consultant, a breastfeeding support group, and teach your family and friends everything you know so they can support you too. Ultimately, Seals Aller says, she'll be happy when all Black moms are given breastfeeding education, widespread support, and celebration, so they can choose what's right for them. Breastfeeding is a social justice issue, she says. We know there's a system that devalues our Black men, our children. This is a way to show we do care about our children. We love them from birth. Okay, we're moving from moms to babies to children. This from Stat News. New research shows many children with mental health conditions don't get follow-up care. A large new study finds that mental health care for many children in the U.S. falls far short, particularly when it comes up to follow-up treatment they receive. The study, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, examined insurance claims from children between the ages of 10 and 17 covered by Blue Cross Blue Shield. Of the more than 2 million children included in the study, nearly 1 in 10 had a claim related to mental illness between 2012 and 2018. The authors found that only 71% of the children received treatment in the 3 months that followed an initial insurance claim. But the study found that rate varied widely from one zip code to the next. In the best performing zip codes, nearly 90% of children received follow-up care within 3 months of an initial insurance claim. In the worst performing areas, only half the children got that care. Of the children treated with medication, nearly 45% were given benzodiazepines, tricyclic antidepressants, or a drug that isn't approved by the FDA for their age range. The study authors referred to those as red flag drugs, meaning how they're being used warrants a closer look. The findings on red flag drugs are particularly concerning, the study's authors said, given that most professional guidelines would suggest starting with another type of antidepressant, an SSRI, in combination with therapy for the majority of children included in the study. In the past, some experts have suggested that shortages of qualified mental health providers are to blame for shortcomings in adolescent mental health care, with pediatricians often left to fill the gap. But the authors concluded that the disparities detailed in the study couldn't be simply explained by staffing shortages. The study found that the number of therapists in a given area is slightly associated with the chance that a child will receive follow-up treatment, but is far more closely correlated with the type of treatment the child receives. In communities where there are more psychiatrists, drug-only treatment and treatment with red flag drugs is more common. In communities with more of a supply of therapists, therapy-only treatment is more prevalent. The study's authors say that this suggests other factors, such as a physician's style of practice, might also play a role. There is a shortage of mental health professionals, but even in places that are well-served, the same conditions are treated in many different ways, some of them harmful, said Janet Curie, an economics and public affairs professor at Princeton University and the study's co-author. I would hope that people will look into this to try to determine what might be effective in remedying the situation, such as better training, clearer guidelines that are available to both doctors and patients, in languages patients can understand, mechanisms for patients to report negative effects of treatment, and so on, said Curie. Okay, well, I'd like to end the show with a completely different story. Change it up here a bit. This is from DW.com. How drugs damage the environment. Whether they smoked a joint on the couch or sniffed a line in a club, some 269 million people around the world indulged in drugs in 2018, according to the United Nations. Cocaine production is at record levels. Opium has been on an upward trend for the past decade. The market for synthetic drugs is growing in the Netherlands, and some countries are legalizing cannabis. In short, business is booming. It is no secret that drug trafficking and cartel wars cost human lives, but so far there has been little focus on how this global trade impacts the environment. Cultivating thirsty marijuana plantations is a serious problem in California, which is plagued by forest fires and drought. With 192 million users in 2018, cannabis is by far the most popular drug worldwide, excluding, of course, alcohol and tobacco. Efforts to legalize marijuana are continuing to gather pace in the United States, where the drug has already become a billion-dollar market. But cultivating the plants in greenhouses with optimum light, ventilation, and temperature guzzles an enormous amount of resources. According to estimates, cannabis production in the U.S. already accounts for around 1% of the country's total energy consumption. Within a single year, approximately 15 million metric tons of carbon dioxide are emitted in the United States as a result of indoor cannabis production, equivalent to the annual emission of 3 million cars, according to the report by the University of California, Davis. That means that a single joint has a similar carbon footprint to about 6.6 pounds of potatoes. Most of the marijuana in the booming U.S. cannabis industry is grown in energy-hungry greenhouses. Cannabis is also an extremely thirsty plant, needing twice as much water as tomatoes or grapes. About 70% of the cannabis consumed across the country is grown in California. Such large-scale cultivation of a crop that requires up to 22 liters, 6 gallons of water per day per plant has only intensified the region's water shortages during dry seasons. Scientists from the California Department of Fisheries and Wildlife estimate that illegal outdoor cultivation has lowered the water level in some flowing streams by up to a quarter. Clearing forests to plant coca. The ecological footprint of the world's 19 million cocaine users is particularly apparent in Latin America. According to the United Nations, Colombia has the potential to produce 1,120 tons of pure cocaine in 2018, a record crop for the South American country. Since 2001, more than 741 million acres of forests have been cleared for the cultivation of coca, the plant that produces cocaine. Following a temporary decline, we actually see the same peak of coca that we were watching 20 years ago, Paulo Sandoval, a geographer at the University of Oregon, said. Colombia's approach, quote, harms the environment. Until now, the Colombian government has relied on a strategy of eradication in its fight against coca cultivation. As part of its campaign, aircraft sprayed plantations with a highly concentrated herbicide glyphosate. This method effectively destroyed many coca plantations, but it also damaged neighboring forests and farmland. Elizabeth Tellman, a geographer at Columbia University's Earth Institute in New York, says this approach harms rather than helps the environment. And once the fields are destroyed, the cartel simply clears more forests elsewhere and plant new coca crops. Coca leaves aren't just grown in the jungle. They're also processed into cocaine in secret laboratories there. This process requires highly toxic chemicals such as ammonia, acetone, and hydrochloric acid. Scientists estimate that several million liters of these substances end up in soils and rivers each year. There are now few aquatic plants or animals living in these contaminated waters, according to a 2015 EU report. Scientists in the Netherlands say the toxic waste produced by the manufacture of illegal drugs pollutes the country's rivers. MDMA, ecstasy, and company. So-called party drugs, from pills to a line of powder in a nightclub bathroom, have grown in popularity in recent years. The Netherlands and Belgium are hotspots for synthetic drugs. The production of a kilo of pure MDMA, the main substance in ecstasy, results in 10 kilos of toxic waste, or 30 kilos in the case of amphetamines. This might include sodium hydroxide, hydrochloric acids, and acetone, substance that would normally have to be disposed of as hazardous waste using protective suits. The Dutch Water Research Institute, KWR, estimates that in 2017, around 7,000 tons of these substances were either dumped somewhere in drums or leaked into the ground and rivers. That's unbelievable, says Eric Emke, a scientist at the KWR. Emke says the waste is sometimes dumped into containers used to collect cattle excrement, becoming mixed with the dung that is spread onto corn crops. And so, 5 years ago, they discovered amphetamine and ecstasy residues in corn lice. Jeremy Douglas, the regional representative at the UN's Office on Drugs and Crime in Southeast Asia, says Thailand, Laos, and Myanmar have also become a hub for industrial-scale global synthetic drug production in recent years. The spillover damage to groundwater and habitats is severe, and frankly, it is nothing short of an ecological and public health disaster, he said. Groundwater sinking in Afghanistan. Around 337,000 football fields, or 23 times the size of Paris. That's the amount of land that was used to cultivate opium worldwide in 2019, according to the United Nations. The main producers are Myanmar, Mexico, and Afghanistan, which accounts for 84% of global cultivation. Poppy fields spread mainly across the country's southwest in areas where, until the 1990s, there was nothing but arid desert. Today, some 1.4 million people live there, making a living from cultivating opium and agriculture. That's all possible thanks to more than 50,000 solar-powered water pumps that have greened the desert. But it is not as green as it sounds. Opium cultivation supports some 1.4 million people in southern Afghanistan, but is also robbing the region of its water. A report by socioeconomist David Mansfield found that the region's groundwater is sinking by about 10 feet per year. Wells as deep as 130 meters, or about 300 feet, are now being drilled to find water. Each year, 400 feet. Okay, I got to work on my metrics. Each year, more people are arriving in the desert installing solar deep wells. There are local fears, and there will fast become a time when agriculture production is no longer viable. The poppy farmers also use chemical fertilizer and strong pesticides to control weeds. Groundwater tests have shown that nitrate levels are significantly higher than what is deemed safe. This can increase the risk of blue baby syndrome, which leads to heart defects and death in newborns. Mansfield warns that if water in the region does eventually run out, it will force large numbers of people from their homes, sparking a rural exodus. Okay, well, on that lovely note, I'll end the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. If you'd like to queue up future shows or listen to past shows, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. All the shows are listed there, as well as each of the segments or articles and their time. So if you want to listen to just part of the show, that's very convenient. If you want to get notifications on Facebook about this show when it is first published, you can search for Just for the Health of It, WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo.
And now a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning. Use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.